Thank you, Tammy. Good morning, everyone. We're going to get started here. Representative Sears requested 30 minutes of speaking time. I said, I've got an opening for you at 9:01.
So we're going to...
Representative Sears, you can have all the time you want at 9:01. Well, just to give you a few numbers right off the bat, as Tammy said, the legislative session started on February 3rd with the governor's State of the State address. And at that time, they had 1,361 House bills that were filed, 840 Senate bills that were filed. That's not including the carryover bills from last session. So that's over 2,200 bills that they've considered. And that were just filed. Yesterday was the first major deadline, and that was that all the bills that were filed had to emerge from the committee level to be considered on down the road. And so I'm not sure what that number is right now, but then they're going to spend the next 2 weeks doing floor action. Now, you guys have been spending a lot of time on the floor for being in committee. So we've gone through the first reading process. And the next deadline for bills to remain alive is March 13th. So they spent 4 weeks in committee. They'll spend 2 weeks on floor action on House bills in the House, Senate bills in the Senate, and then they'll cross over, and the Senate committees will hear the House bills and vice versa in the House. There are 101 members in the Oklahoma House of Representatives, 77 Republicans, 23 Democrats, and one vacancy, 48 members of the Senate, 38 Republican, 9 Democrat, and 1 vacancy. One thing about the 77 or the 101 members of the House, 47 are in their first term. Over half are in their first term. That is scary. Nothing personal.
No, it's scary.
All right. Well, guys, you have $85.5 million less to spend this year than last year, so it's kind of a flat budget. So, Senator, I'll start with you. If you can talk a little bit about the budget process, as everyone knows, doesn't really get kicked into gear and finalized until May. But talk a little bit about the budget process, what you forecast, and then also how that goes hand-in-hand with the governor's Medicaid program, which there were a couple bills filed late this week were not heard by the deadline, so speak to that going forward.
Okay, I will do that in 20 words or less. Hello?
Yes.
First of all, Tri-County, thank you for having us. Thank you for that wonderful story about Garrett. That is just great. Appreciate my chamber, my city. It's a thrill to be able to serve. I appreciate you giving me the honor and privilege. Just to start off really, really quick, because I think this was kind of cool yesterday. Yesterday was the 100th anniversary of the adoption of the 19th Amendment, giving women the right to vote. And I was presiding in the Senate when the female majority leader, the female minority leader, were up there to have the resolution read, which is really pretty cool. And then we got all the women senators, and the chief of staff of the pro tem is a lady, and the director of all the Senate staff is a lady. So it was a pretty neat deal yesterday to be up there in the chair with the gavel looking out on everybody. And all of the gentlemen we serve with, they're just wonderful, and they were as excited as we were about the commemoration. That amendment was adopted in 1921, but Oklahoma gave women the right to vote in 1918. So we can be ahead of the times in lots of ways. Okay, so yes, I also serve on the Appropriations Committee, and while Representative Wilt is correct that we're just now getting into it, on Wednesday we heard 60 bills in appropriations, because anything that touches money has to go through its substantive committee and then come to appropriations. Well, you learn that almost everything in that building touches money in some way. So I hear a lot of bills 3 and 4 times before they ever get to the floor. The flat budget does mean that all the requests for increased spending will be given a lot of scrutiny. There was a cushion of about $300 billion left over last year because, you know, we can only appropriate 95% of the certified estimate, and that other 5%, 95.5%, it's held over. But a lot of those dollars will be spent on one-time expenditures, like we have to make ad valorem payments. And this year there'll be a little bit over $100 million. So when people think, oh, you've got that extra money to make up for the $84 million less, this year, but some of that is already committed. So hats off to the governor for telling his agencies, the ones over which he does have some authority, say, you go in there and ask for a flat budget. I know in the judiciary public safety budget meetings that has happened, and we're getting a lot more presentations about agencies cooperating with each other, which is really, really helpful. Because while some in the minority party do not understand this, you don't have to raise taxes to increase spending if you make efficiencies in government. You save money, you can spend it someplace else. All of you in business understand how that works. And Governor Stitt's bringing that attitude to our building. Medicaid, that is a sticky wicket. I'm against the expansion of Medicaid. I always have been. I don't believe it has anything to do with health outcomes. I believe we could approach this in a different way. But again, the money is so attractive, and it seems so easy. You give 10%, the feds give 90%. What could be wrong with that? Medicaid is not medical insurance. It is direct payment for patient care. And we would be adding able-bodied, working-age adults to the list. In the state question, we would have no flexibility as a legislature to tailor this to our needs. We would have to do whatever the feds say, and once it's in the Constitution, if they change it or they pull back their 90%, who's going to make up the difference? So I don't want it in my Constitution. We are trying to negotiate with the governor a dollar figure that we in the House and Senate could stiffen up and say, yes, we support this, to get his plan going. Those negotiations are ongoing. We haven't settled on something that we can all agree on yet. So hopefully here in the next week or so, I'm always optimistic that will happen. So that's about all I know about Medicaid today.
And just for those, it's the initiative petition on the Medicaid expansion being put in the Constitution is kind of under the radar. Could you give like a 30-second description of that?
Yes, it has cleared the challenges to the Supreme Court. They found it constitutional because, of course, the people of Oklahoma can amend their constitution any way they want. And if we want to be beholden to the federal government for this piece of medical care, well, that's up to us. But the governor has to set that on an election date sometime this year. And he has not made that decision yet. And I think that's in part because he wants to see what we can do with his proposal. I hope that's helpful. But yes,
but it would put Medicaid into the Constitution.
Absolutely, it would. The expansion population.
If it was voted, yes. Representative Strong, you serve on Business and Commerce Committee in the House. Talk a little bit about some of the legislation that's coming through your committee, coming through the House that pertains to business and industry.
First, thank you for letting me be here. It's always just a wonderful opportunity to get to come and speak with everyone at home. As far as business and commerce, I think what you would understand is what we've done most this year is work to remove regulations, to open up and give business greater flexibility to operate the way that they want. We've had in the past, it seems like we've worked to add more regulations to businesses, to kind of direct businesses in the way that we thought that they needed to go from the state. We've completely done a turnaround on that, and we're coming back to it and open that up to let business operate it the way that they want to. And that's the way that I think that more Oklahomans want to have the ability to run their business. Business and commerce has been a busy time this year. I think almost every committee that we've been into has had anywhere from 20 to 30 different bills every day that we've been in committee to get through. There have been some heated exchanges, and there have been some that just sailed through because everyone in the room was just ready to get that kind of legislation running. So really, I think just to reiterate on that, I think freeing up regulations to allow people to run their businesses the way they want would be what you would consider the theme of the Business and Commerce Committee this year.
Representative Fincher, you're on a couple of money committees when it comes to education, and I know that's on down the road. What about policy matters, policy bills that are coming through the committee level and the House eventually that pertain to education?
Thank you, and thank you to Tri-County Tech for having us here. This is a great venue. There are several. I'm on a couple of different education.
Is this one on?
Got to get close enough, right? Sorry. Thanks. I'm on a couple of different education committees. One of them is, excuse me, everybody's got a little leftover cold. One of them is A&B budget, and the other one is higher ed and career tech. And so in AMB budget, we've been looking at several things. One is the COLA. We passed the COLA last year. We're waiting for the Senate for the cost of living that actually deals with the teachers that we have. And the reason we have that over there is this actually gets down to how do you end up retaining your teachers. We have passed some bills that are out that are coming out of the Senate that makes it easier for teachers who show up with a certificate to start teaching immediately. They don't have to get an Oklahoma certificate right off the bat. They just have to get a certificate, or they have to have a valid certificate, and then they've got a year to pass the exam so you can hire them right off the bat to be able to do this. But at the end of it, if you want people to teach here, you also have to make sure that if they think they have a commitment, if they think that they have a commitment at the end for their pension, we want to make sure that we're able to deliver on that. And through the work of people before us for the past several years, we've been putting money in there, and hopefully we'll actually be able to get to that. One of the other areas that we're working on is what's called in education concurrent enrollment. This is where students in high school can actually take courses for college credit. And that's with partnership with either our universities or through our community colleges. One of the bills that came out, we're fully funding concurrent enrollment for all high school seniors. We want to fully fund it for all high school juniors. But we can't do that if the amount of values that you're actually, or the amount of money that you're paying for every course varies, because every university has a slightly different cost. And so we have a bill that just came out of AMB that basically focuses on setting that cost at the average of the junior college level, at the community college level, for the credit hour. That was unpopular with some of the higher ed universities because their costs are higher to offer courses. They pay more for their faculty and everything else. But the Board of Regents of Higher Ed also makes sure that, because these are general education courses, they're the same no matter where you take them. It's not like you get a better course at a university. If you take it at a community college, you're getting the same content, the same background, the same skills that you can do in there to move, to go forward. And so it's at that level, it's a commodity because they're all highly skilled people. And so we're focusing on that. Part of the reason for the bill was to help the universities focus on how are we going to make sure that this is successful and that we're able to offer this to everybody else. One of the other bills that's coming is run by Chair Baker of the Common Ed Committee, which is a bill to require every school in Oklahoma to offer at least 4 AP courses. Unfortunately, we have some schools that do not offer any AP courses at all, and they do not have concurrent enrollment. Every student in a small school needs large school opportunities, and this is one step towards making sure that we have large school opportunities for them.
And just so you know, that would not affect Bartlesville or Cane Valley because they already do that. Dewey offers 3. It would affect Copan, which doesn't have any right now. We're a very populous state, as we know. We all like to vote on everything. Senator, we've got several joint resolutions coming out of the Senate that would propose sending to a vote of the people increasing the rainy day fund, constitutional convention, tort reform, as you know, and then tweaking the tobacco settlement. Can you talk a little bit about those briefly?
Yes, thank you. And all of those either came through judiciary or, because I serve on rules, I heard and voted on those bills this week. Rainy Day Fund, the proposal is to raise the cap from 15% or 20%, I can't remember where it is right now, to 30. And there's a misunderstanding here that this means that every year that you have any surplus, it's all going to go in there, and that literally you're going to try and put enough money in there to get 30% straight off the bat. But it only means that when you have a booming economy, you're going to have more surplus of the estimate from the Equalization Board that you can put in there. And the issue has been that we went through really, really bad times for 2 or 3 years, and we depleted our rainy day fund. And again, we have a governor who wants to have a certain number of months of operating dollars. We all understand that, don't we, City? Cash flow, to be able to run government and not decimate these budgets. Keep everything on an even keel. We did get that out of committee, but there's a lot of pushback because people don't understand that a cap doesn't mean you're going to start pushing a lot of money in there every year to get to the 30%. And it's up to you. My minority friends kept saying, we shouldn't do this. And the author said, don't we want the people to decide how much money they want to save? to prepare for a downturn. So that one will probably end up on the ballot. Constitutional Convention, that's my friend Senator Newhouse trying his best to say, hello, our Constitution says we're supposed to do this every 10 years and we've never done it, and look at our Constitution. I voted for it. I think we should start planning for one. Will it make it off both floors and onto the ballot? I don't know. But there are lots of people who think that means that you would go in and completely rewrite your Constitution. And a lot of people who rely on precedent and case law are saying you would screw up all the case law in our state if you did anything to rewrite our Constitution. So that one is a good idea, but again, it has a high hurdle. TSET. Drew Edmondson, who was Attorney General back when he sued the tobacco companies and got all this put in place, was quoted this week as saying, I am not going to let anybody eviscerate TSET. Now, eviscerate to me means cut it up into little pieces and it's gone. All that's being proposed is that from the new money coming in each year, this is over $1 billion, and they have gains that they reinvest, and they only spend the interest. But every year we're getting payments from the Tobacco Settlement Trust. All we're saying is we're going to take some of that and we're going to use it to pay for our portion of Medicaid. Whether we expand Medicaid or not, we're going to use it for direct health care costs. It's a revenue source that I believe we're not fully using. But those who form TSET are very protective of it. And so they are making it seem like we're going to take all the money out of the principal and we're going to take all the money coming from the tobacco companies, and that's not the case. It's really fairly mild because it'll continue to grow. Some of the money will go in and continue to grow along with the gains that they have that they reinvest. And they will do exactly what they have been doing, but we as a legislature will have a revenue stream for these growing health care costs, and they are not slowing down. So that is why we are looking at TSET. Tort reform, really quickly. Sadly, the Republican majority worked for years to win the hearts and minds of Oklahomans, to go in and become a more business-friendly state and establish more certainty for job creators and employees about what they can expect in operating their business in Oklahoma. This last year, we had some very poor decisions come down from the Supreme Court, and we are actually going to have to ask the people to take the statute on lawsuit reform and put it in the Constitution. Because our Supreme Court decided that they just overturned it. They just threw out everything, saying the legislature did not have the authority under the Constitution to set policy on the cap on damages, even though we set caps on lots of things. And even though our Constitution is expansive in the authority it gives the legislature, not like the U.S. Constitution that says you can only do these things. The state constitution says they can do a lot more. And we were simply adopting policy that's been adopted in other states. It gives businesses certainty, and they threw it out. And so now we're asking the people to please help us maintain these reforms that are good for economic development and business security. And if you want to be a business-friendly state, these are things that are in the weeds for most people. But for those of you who run a business or are thinking of coming to Oklahoma, this is a very, very important topic.
So all of those things are over in the Senate. If they make it through the legislative process, then they'll be put on the ballot. But another way to get a state question on the ballot is the initiative petition process. And I know, Representative Strong, that the Speaker had a couple of bills kind of tweaking the initiative petition process. Can you speak a little bit to that?
Yeah. You know, it seems like anything that we won't do in the legislature, your elected officials, people will go around and get some signatures put on a ballot and stand outside wherever's the best place to stand for whatever the petition is, and you can get it put right into our Constitution if need be. Works pretty slick. Those go pretty fast. The speakers had two bills to modernize these initiative petition. One of which would be, right now it's not technically an initiative petition until the governor assigns it to an election, to what, you know, the primary, the general, the runoff elections. What we would do is move that back to where, when it gets its number. And part of that would be, would increase transparency as far as where the money is coming from to fund one side or the other of that initiative petition. We want to know if that money is coming from a real grassroots organization right here in the state that's trying to better our state, or is it coming from somewhere outside of the state? And I keep saying one of the coasts, but I hate to, I guess, I guess it sounds bad when I do that, but a lot of these initiative petitions that do come into our state are coming from outside sources there. So that would provide transparency to the voters and give them a real idea of where this movement is coming from. So I think both of those would help, because we talk about Oklahoma, while we call ourselves really one of the freest states, we have one of the longest constitutions or the biggest constitutions there is, and it's dangerous to put things like Medicaid or the expansion into our constitution. What happens if we lose it in 5 years or 4 years? Well, we're still bound by our constitution to follow it. And then as well, when things get put under our constitution, they're set hard and fast in there. We as legislators, as ideas change, or as the people's ideas change of how that, we can't go and work on those things. You have to go through a different process. So you can't send us down there, your legislators, to actually fix it. I'm very excited about seeing the changes to the initiative petition process, because while people say things like, well, we're going to take it out of the hands of politicians and let the people speak, we're there for a reason. We represent people from all over the state, and while, yes, they're politicians, I'm not. No, I'm just kidding. I am. But I think that that's the way it should. You're representative officials. Your duly elected representative officials in the state should have a greater hand in how our statutes operate and how the state operates than maybe a, well, coastal funded movement in our state.
So. Real quick story. Back in the early 90s, we had people circulating a petition that ended up resulting in a grand jury being impaneled. But people were signing the petition because they thought they were voting against the building of a Walmart supercenter. True story. Representative Fincher, one of the bill that passed out of committee headed to the House floor deals with virtual schools. There's also some legislation out there, something called the Virtual Everywhere Bill. I know that's one of your hot button issues. Talk a little bit about that.
Thank you for the question. That's how we start debates on the floor during the question and answer. So there is a bill that came out of committee that deals with virtual schools. I filed a couple of bills on virtual schools that would deal with transfers between them. Many people don't realize that when you transfer between virtual schools, it's not a transfer. Right now, students live within 6 resident school districts. In the old days, when they were all brick and mortar, you could only live in 1 school district at a time. You went elsewhere, it was a transfer. Now you live in 6 resident school districts. And what can happen then is your resident school district, if you're not a charter school, has to take you. Well, the statewide virtual charter schools are charter schools. One of the schools will take anybody who shows up at any time. The challenge school districts have run into is that when a student will often go to one of the virtual charter schools, enroll, and then they will come back to the regular school because they find out the virtual program isn't for them. And the only time the school knows that they're actually leaving is when they get notified to send records over. My bill dealt with assuring that there was a notification period to the school before they moved. And because it's an enrollment and not a transfer, it's not really tracked. Just trying to get information on how often that happened between Bartlesville and one of the virtual schools took several months from the State Department of Ed, and at the end they were going through the data manually out of their report to figure out what actually happened. The bill would make that a transfer instead of just an enrollment. There's a notification period. You get some opportunity to move, an opportunity to move once a year. After that, both superintendents have to agree. I worked with Representative Dills to make sure this ended up in her bill, because to make life easier, sometimes it's better to run a big bill that addresses all the issues at once than it is to try to do a whole bunch of small bills. And she was addressing some other issues with virtual schools, so this is rolled into her bill, and that's the one that came off the floor. It's going to bring more transparency to virtual schools because of some of the other provisions in there, so we'll know a lot more about what's going on. That's totally separate from the Oklahomans Virtually Everywhere Act. The Oklahomans Virtually Everywhere Act is a bill that passed last year that I sponsored. And basically, the whole goal of the Oklahomans Virtually Everywhere, you think, well, what does that mean? One of our challenges is getting people to come here to the state. And if you're in rural Oklahoma, it becomes more complex to build large employing capacity. I mean, if you're Pryor and you've got the facilities to get Google in, that's really good. But not every place in Oklahoma has a capacity. You get up to, like, the panhandle. I'm suite mates with Representative Pat Skowski, who has the entire panhandle plus more. Yet we have people who have a lot of knowledge, have a lot of skills, have a lot of expertise that we can actually export everywhere. So the question is, how can I work anywhere in the world without leaving where I am? And so the Oklahoma Virtually Everywhere Act asks a bunch of agencies to come together and start doing a proposal on how we do this. We've got the draft report done. They've been working on it. They've been keeping in touch with me. Senator Daniel sponsored that. They came in and had a brief conversation to show her the progress has gone on with it. So we're moving forward with that. Our next step is to go find some money. Do we have any money, Representative?
Nope.
So where do you find money? Well, turns out I happen to know one of the secretaries has a little bit of money stashed away. So we're going to call in the Secretary of Digital Transformation, and the agencies will make their pitch to him for a small amount of money that he actually has to support things like this so we can start running a pilot project. So that this is the first step. Our pilot project will work on education and helping will be with our libraries, several library systems throughout the state. How, if you don't have a high school diploma, say you dropped out, you had a year left or half a year and you're in your mid-30s, or you only did 2 years of high school and you're in your mid-30s, how do you get a high school diploma instead of a GED? Turns out there's a process for that. We're going to make this so that people can come in, do it. It will pay for tuition. It allows us to show how to do it virtually throughout the state. That's our first step. There will be much more to come on that. Thank you.
Senator, you're chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. I know we voted as a people on a lot of criminal justice reforms. There was a meeting between victims' rights groups and people that are wanting more lenient criminal justice measures. So what's happening in that area at the Capitol this session?
Okay, thank you for that question. Just want to point out that Debbie Muggenberg serves on, I believe it's the Endowment Trust. Which committee is it of TSET?
The Board of Trustees.
The Board of Trustees. So she's one of those responsible for making sure that that fund continues to invest and earn that money to grow for all of the marvelous TSET programs and the research they're doing. So we're really glad to have her. I'll just brag on her a little bit. When I sent her bio to the governor, he wrote back and said, I have never seen a biography like that before. He was just astounded at her multiple talents. So we're really glad to have her there. And one other thing, the lawsuit reform resolution, that is mine. So I'm carrying that in the Senate. Okay, you asked me about criminal justice reform. And I want to start off by thanking Chief Rolls, thanking Sheriff Owen, thanking Kevin Buchanan, thanking Matt Ballard in Rogers County, and Captain McElhaney in Nowata, and the people involved in criminal justice reform, because I have bills that tend to overlap all of their areas of responsibility. And you can imagine that when you try to do any reform, it's a very scary process. And so this year, I took this one on fines and fees, knowing full well that each group I was working with would not be happy with the end product. And since it may have a fiscal impact, it may not go anywhere this year. But we want to keep the conversations going on these issues. I do know we have one on resentencing that's passed the Senate, and I think that's to help the district attorneys and the public defenders. The public defenders called me, said, we really like this bill. We want you to add something that will help us with our clients who don't always understand the process in which they're involved. So I've got the district attorneys and the public defenders working together on an amendment. And then passed one on jailhouse confessions. And this was one, again, that the criminal justice reformers were in favor of. But the district attorneys could also see the sense of, if you're going to get testimony from a jailhouse confession, you know, where your fellow prisoner squeals on you, everybody needs to know where it came from, what you promised that person in return for their testimony. Have they ever offered testimony like that before? So how trustworthy are they? And just everybody needs to know this up front so that they can take that into their calculation about how reliable the testimony is. And so that's kind of up to date. The criminal justice reformers are frustrated. They want it all and they want it now. And they don't always think about how it impacts the costs and the payment for the court system. And so when I want to roll back a fine or fee or limit the way in which you can punish somebody for not paying all of it on time, that upsets the sheriffs because they get money from that. That upsets the OSBI because they get money from that. CLEAT, all sorts of agencies that are outside the court system receive monies from these fines and fees. So it's a multi-year process, and I captured the bill so that I could work with these groups that don't necessarily see eye to eye and see what I can do to get real reform that everybody can live with.
I'm going to stay on that topic for just a moment. All three of you, is there any kind of a sense, I mean, everybody knows the prison population is overcrowded and whatnot, that maybe there's a point that maybe we go too far, go too lenient? What's kind of the atmosphere amongst just everybody down there, both in the House and the Senate?
Well, I will speak frankly and say that in an election year, not many people are going to be criminal justice reformers because in their communities, you know, they're worried about public safety. And when we pass 780 and make all these drug crimes perpetual misdemeanors, we compromised public safety in our communities, in my view. Fortunately, you did not amend the Constitution to do that. You put it in statute so that we can work on trying to correct some of the overzealous pieces of that that particular question. But it's a balancing act. It really is. And that's really all I can say. It's a balancing act. Do you want to add to that, Daryl?
I'll agree with Senator Daniels. This is a balancing act that we're doing. We're also talking about various ways of approaching it. Some people think we're way too lenient already. Some people think, oh, we're still way too harsh. But she's right. In election year, that's going to be a balancing act. Now, one of the things that we've started talking about is we have a drug court. How do we make those more effective? But one of our challenges for law enforcement is the mental health issues that they have among so many of the people that they pick up. And those people need more help than we can actually get into jail. And it's very expensive to keep them there. So we've started talking about, is there ways to do mental health court, the long-term view? How do we support that? Because ultimately, we want people to be back and productive members of society. And if we can get them the help for that, that's one way that we could actually move forward with that. Representative?
Can I add one thing, just while I'm thinking of it? So there's a bill in the Senate that we have passed where when law enforcement encounters somebody that's in a mental health crisis, you know that Grand Lake Mental Health pioneered using the iPads that are in Osage County, and maybe they're now in Washington County, where they immediately try to connect the person with a mental health professional and determine, do they need to be arrested and go to jail, or do they just need to go home and take their meds, or do they need to be transported to a facility? And we're working towards making it the responsibility of mental health to transport them if they need to go to a facility and take that burden off of law enforcement because they haven't actually arrested the individual. And I think we may come to some meeting of the minds on that one, and it's moving through the Senate pretty handily.
I think that's a great deal. I wanted to add to what Mr. Fincher said about, well, we do spend a lot of time talking about criminal justice. There's also the instance that we have to consider of victim justice. And I think that that's what a lot of people see is when something happens to them, they want that person to go to jail. Well, we filled up our jails. And so what we're working on with a lot of the 780, the people that are coming out, are people, a lot of these are drug crimes that they were criminals against the state because they were in possession of drugs or something. And while I know they might have been harming their family or something by what they were doing, they weren't necessarily thieves or criminals or, you know, by that in that nature. And so one thing we worked on and a lot of things that have come through judiciary is you say we want to turn out a productive member of society out of our jails. Well, a lot of times when we arrest somebody, we put them in jail because we want to punish them. We turn them out and expect them to be a productive member of society. They didn't know how to do that before they went into jail. So you don't punish them into this whole new, well, I've been in jail, I'm going to come out and I'm going to live like you now. They've never seen that. They don't know how to do that. And so what we're working on is trying to give resources to our facilities to maybe to teach, to educate, to get mental health help, to get drug court, or to get drug and alcohol and substance abuse help. As well, one thing that we always work on and we discuss is we arrest a criminal, we create an inmate, and we turn out a felon. we need to start looking at the idea of arresting a criminal. What can we do to intervene or to better that person and then turn out a productive member of society? And the little things we've been working on this year in judiciary are making sure before that person gets out, and this is new legislation that's coming through, making sure before we turn this person out that if they had a driver's license before, we get them the resources to get a driver's license when they get out. If they had a particular certification for work or a job or a school certification, we want to make sure that whatever we can do is done, that that certification is continued, or that they can continue, they can get out and still be a plumber or still be an electrician if, you know, if it hasn't just expired way out. But those are little things we can do rather than just opening the jail gates and saying, now get. You know, and so I think that's those are important things to do, because ultimately we don't want to turn criminals back out onto the street. We want to turn productive members of society back out in the, on the street as best as we can.
Okay, I mean, you started this conversation, so I've got... No, you are exactly right. Because my first statement was, in an election year, nobody's going to be in favor of criminal justice reform. That was a bit flippant. Actually, the DOC and pardon and parole, because of that whole commutation process and that push, you know, they're now going to merge. We're going to save money and have more money to spend on exactly what Representative Judd Strom is saying, because we were duplicating services in Department of Corrections and Pardon and Parole and found out they work really well together. So the governor says, let's merge you two to do more of this effective training and intervention. Occupational licensing reform. Now, I worked on that last year, and I've got Representative Taylor's bill this year. Going through all of these bills that say you cannot get a license to be a CPA unless you are a person of good moral character and you haven't committed any act of moral turpitude. Well, that's very open-ended. So we started working saying, we're taking that language out. If what they want to learn to do is going to be compromised in any way by the nature of their crime, then you need to tell them up front, don't bother to take the CPA exam if you've got a string of convictions for embezzlement. But if you want to go be a plumber, that's fine. And that kind of thing. So we're working through all these statutes that have to do with licensing to try and do what Representative Strom said. Don't let them loose without some hope. And then on the juvenile side, which we're now going to try to put with the adult side, how much can you do to keep them from ever entering the system? Because if you intervene and you can keep them out of the criminal justice system, they may not be model citizens, but they will be a lot better than, as you said, they would be if they serve time in jail. So it's a real big, very interesting issue, and obviously we're not going to resolve it in a short time.
Now, this one is being challenged a second time for the gist, for the description that goes on the ballot. I'm opposed to the state question. Redrawing district boundaries is inherently political. Whether you do it by something called an independent commission or your elected representatives and senators who are redrawing the boundary lines for the institution in which they serve and the congressional boundary lines, that is where it is appropriate to do that. The tagline on this, it started out people, not politicians. Well, you can see from these issues we've discussed today, you have to learn a lot when you get down there. And you can't always say yes to everybody because you know how it's going to impact this over here. Medical marijuana, the legislature had their chance and they didn't do it, so we had to do it ourselves. Well, it's still illegal federally, and we were struggling with that. So we get one bite of the apple and then it goes to the Constitution. But this is a fundamental change in how you will redistrict. There's never been a case of gerrymandering in Oklahoma, but the tagline now is stop gerrymandering. The closest I know to gerrymandering is Oklahoma is when this county was in District 5. We would have had Congressman Hearn. Congresswoman Hearn would have been our congressman if somebody hadn't seen sense a few years ago and understood that we belong in the 1st District or the 2nd District. So it's real problematic for me, again, for over 100 years, the Democrats controlled the state completely. They redistricted what? That means 9 or 10 times. But nobody ever said that was political. But we have redistricted once as a Republican Party. And now suddenly we're all politicians and it needs to be taken away from us. You need to read State Question 804, an 11-page constitutional amendment. You need to read it carefully about the special masters and how you get to be on the commission. You could never have been associated with the legislature anyway. You can't be a stepdaughter, a stepson. I mean, they are really making sure that it's a tiny population. You're going to have people on that commission who do not have seats in the House and the Senate. They haven't won the hearts and minds of people enough to get an elected seat in the legislature, but they'll have a seat at the table. So you really need to read it. I hope it doesn't clear this second hurdle, but if it does, we should be very concerned about it. This has to do broadly with when President Obama was in office, he was doing well at the federal level, but they lost all these state legislators and a lot of city councils and school boards. And this is now an effort to go around the traditional methods to be able to boost the Democrats in these red states. And I mean, that's just honestly, that's what it is. And so it's a power grab, and we should be very careful not to fundamentally jeopardize the constitutional republic we live in. Same thing with the Electoral College. It's the same people pushing to get rid of the Electoral College. I've gone on too long, but as you can tell, I have a half-baked opinion on this.
Thank you, Senator. Just very briefly, I think the assumption is that we were gerrymandering. If you go back and look, and you'll find out a lot more about how we actually do redistrict as we get closer to it. I've looked at how we do it. When we redistricted last time, you know, in the House, the minority leader talked about what a great process it was and how it was listened to. You're going to be hearing more about that. You're going to be seeing more. You look at our districts, they really aren't that wackily shaped. I mean, matter of fact, I think the fact that we talked about, I don't include Ramona, it's because we try to keep units together. So that's why I go around the main side of Ramona. That's why here in Bartlesville, the major division is Frank Phillips Boulevard between myself and Representative Strom, or the train tracks. It's very simple. We try to keep units together.
This kind of goes back to our clarity and our initiative petition process. You know, what we see on this is people, they say people, not politics, is fighting for this. There again, I'd ask you to find out where the money came from to fund this organization. They say that you want to take it out of the hands of politicians, closed door process, put it back in the hands of a committee, an elected committee, so there's nothing over it. I ask you to remember the last time they redrew the district lines, we were a Democrat state. They redrew the district lines, and then we had a swing to the other side. So obviously we're not very good if we are trying to actually gerrymander to keep our seats and positions. The thing is, what they don't give us, the idea is we represent the people as far as people, not politics. We don't have lifelong, we have term limits. We don't have lifelong politicians that are staying in there. We have an open door appealable process that is bipartisan, that anyone can come in and look at the plans right on the table and see what's going on. And so they're actually fighting for what they want using what we already do, trying to convince us that we're not doing it that way. And so we already have what we think is the absolute best way to draw our district lines in this state, that it's not getting the right people elected as far as someone from Virginia thinks, and so they want to change that. And if you think about it being all retired district judges, consider that most of our retired district judges that are in the state of Oklahoma right now are Brad Henry's retired district judges or Supreme Court judges. So that'd be who you would have voting on where your district lines go.
Okay. One more thing, census, because this has to do with redrawing lines. April 1 is census day. By then you should have received your census form. You can also do this online. Those counts affect what the two redistricting committees in the House and Senate are going to do. I've already seen my district and how the last census estimate is playing out, and I'm already looking at how they may say to redraw District 29. So we all need to fill out the census. It's not only about federal dollars, but it's about how you redraw the boundaries for everything in the state.
Keep in mind, the district boundaries are all based on population. The reason that Representative Strom's district looks the way it does today is because 10 years ago, it was losing population. So they had to come, his district had to come more into the Bartlesville area, Circle Mountain, Oak Park, deeper in the reason Representative Fincher's district dips down into Tulsa County and Rogers County is because that's where a lot of the population, it's all based on population. And that's why you get some of the weird district boundaries. Well, I want to be respectful of your time. It is very difficult to serve in the legislature, but even